Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. The second half of your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra season is about to start, and here to talk about the next concert is Ward Stair, the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra music director. Welcome back, Ward.
Hi, Julia. Nice to see you.
Great to have you here. So let's take a quick look back at your first half. Are you happy?
Very happy. Felt almost like an entire season in and of itself because we were so busy. But I thought it was just a great way to open the season. Lots of fantastic music making by our orchestra and our guest artists. Great variety, you know, wonderful audiences the whole way along. So I couldn't be more pleased.
Well, you have lots more musical fireworks in store for us.
We do.
And our soloist for this week, James Ennis, the violinist, could not be here today because he just got off the plane.
Literally, yeah.
So we're going to give him a little break and talk to you a little bit about the piece that James Ennis is going to be playing, which is Beethoven's Violin Concerto. This is a work, Ward, that did not have a glorious start. In fact, it premiered to some boos and some hisses. It did not succeed. And then, many years later, 38 years later to be precise, a 12-year-old Yosef Joachim played it, and kaboom, it was a massive hit. So what happened in those 38 years between the failure and the success?
Well, that's a good question. I wasn't around to see it myself, of course, but sometimes a piece just needs a little bit of time to be absorbed by the public, and also I think sometimes it needs the right artist to use it as a vehicle, and then when you have that perfect marriage of a piece with the right artist, then it can really just explode. And I think the reason that it's been such a huge part of the repertoire ever since is that it's just such an astoundingly beautiful piece. I mean, it's a little bit, if you look at the concertos, a typical concerto, you know, of around Beethoven's time, you know, like a Mendelssohn concerto, say, or even the Brahms. I mean, the Brahms are closer to the Beethoven, of course, but the first movement is just enormous. I mean, the first movement in and of itself is about 25 minutes long, which is longer than many complete concertos that have been written up to that point. So I think that might have been part of it. The audience just, you know, it was a lot for them to take in when it was first premiered.
In fact, it's longer than the other two movements combined.
That's right, yeah.
It's well over half of it. And it is almost a complete concerto unto itself. However, having said that, it's an interesting concerto because while there are some fireworks in it, there seems to be a very gentle, bouncy, happy, dancey thing that threads through it, not the big drama, but something lighter than that.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a beautiful expression of Beethoven's humanity throughout. I mean, from beginning to end, you get a gentle beginning, which starts with the solo timpani, which is unusual in and of itself. Four notes played only by the timpani to begin, and then you get a very gentle rolling chorale figure in the woodwinds, and it's very beautiful, but it's not what you would expect at the time for the opening of a virtuoso concerto piece for a violinist. You know, you'd expect some, you know, flashy, you know, extroverted, full-throated opening, but Beethoven didn't do that. He sort of right from the beginning, he sets us up, I think, for a more thoughtful experience, and it's very it's very calming, it's very soothing, it's very reassuring, and it allows us to really have a great dialogue with the soloist, and I think it allows the listener to have a dialogue with Beethoven, if I can go that far and stretch it, because, you know, there's a lot of back and forth. There's a long introduction for the orchestra as well. I mean, for a while you think, what am I, conducting another symphony of Beethoven's? You know, is the soloist ever going to play? But then when he does come in, again, the orchestra eventually does come to a full boil, and then it winds down, and we have the first entrance of the soloist, who sort of just, you know, politely walks in the room to start the conversation. Again, it's very understated for a virtuoso, you know, piece, and it is very much a virtuoso piece. But it requires, I think, the right dynamic between the soloist and the orchestra in terms of the music making itself, not just balance. And from the soloist, it requires a real poet. And so I'm thrilled that we have James Ennis with us this week, because he is he's a lot of things, but I think one of my favorite things about his playing is it's very poetic, it's very expressive, it's very honest.
The second movement, traditionally the gentle movement, mm-hmm. is an interesting one, because a lot of the second movements feature some sort of call and response, mm-hmm. or some kind of dialogue. The violinist in the second movement of the Beethoven works very hard. Violinist plays almost nonstop. It's more of a soliloquy of love than a dialogue.
Well, it's a song. The second movement is just a beautiful song. That's how I think of it. It's tremendously lyrical and, again, very thoughtful, somewhat introverted, and very personal, I think.
When we get to the third movement, it's Beethoven. It's a violin concerto. And we're looking for that big bang, that big bang we always get. And you don't get it.
No. It's just fun, but it's very lighthearted. It's very it's playful. The word playful comes into my mind just immediately, and as I'm studying it, getting ready to do it again. And I've done this piece many times, and it always feels fresh, and it always feels vibrant. And I think ending again in an atypical way, really, where there's not a lot of fireworks. It's just it's a nice rondo. It's, you know, back and forth, very simple themes, but extremely playful, gives the solo line an opportunity to really dance and shine and shimmer without being overblown, which I think is really a beautiful thing. The whole package together creates just a very warm, fuzzy feeling by the end.
And it really reminds you of what beautiful melodies Beethoven was capable of writing, and you'll walk out humming that one.
It's true, and Beethoven is not typically known as a melodist, you know, like maybe Mozart or Tchaikovsky or Schubert, but he does give us some very beautiful melodies which certainly stick with you.
Now, what about cadenzas? Because Beethoven, being a pianist, didn't leave any cadenzas for this thing, so now what?
Well, I wish James was here to talk about it, because I'm sure he could he'd have a lot of fascinating things to say about the Beethoven in particular, but just cadenzas in general. It's always a question. It's always the first question that I have for, you know, the soloist: which cadenzas are you playing? Many people have written cadenzas for the Beethoven, from Kreisler to Schnittke. I mean, it's a very wide range that soloists have to choose from. So I don't actually know yet, sitting here right now, which cadenzas James is planning to play. But I'm excited to find out.
What do you do as a conductor in a case like that? Do you need to have them on your stand, or do you just have a blank hole with a number of measures that the soloist is going to take, and then you dive in?
Well, I mean, with the standard cadenzas, you don't really need them. If there was a cadenza that I wasn't familiar with that was really out there, I might want to have it on the stand, but, you know, it has to come back harmonically to the right place, because when the orchestra comes back in, it has to line up. So, you know, you just listen for that, and unless there's a big curveball thrown at you in the middle, you can usually get away, and you usually know. You can feel the arc of the cadenza, and that's also what rehearsals are for, so you have a shot at it before you have to do it in front of public.
And hope that he doesn't change his mind on the cadenza.
Although I've seen performances where a soloist decided to... usually it's pianists these days, because very few soloists improvise cadenzas on the spot, but I've seen it where a soloist was improvising a cadenza, and it didn't exactly go well. I wasn't the conductor, I was just in the audience, and the others involved shall remain nameless. But the pianist got to a point in the cadenza where harmonically it was time for the orchestra to come back in, and he'd been playing for, you know, maybe a minute and a half, which is about, you know, 2 minutes cadenza. And the conductor and I, sitting out in the audience, thought, okay, it's time. Everyone thought it was time, but the pianist decided to continue that harmony for another bar, and it didn't, you know, it came back together after a couple bars, but it was kind of like, whoa, one of those moments. So it can be dangerous. It can also be fun when you're in a situation like that. But no, for the Beethoven, we usually know ahead of time what the cadenza is going to be.
Now, the rest of the program is all about the dance, and very specifically, it's about the waltz. And the first one is the Valse Noble et Sentimental, the Noble and Sentimental works, Noble and Sentimental Waltzes by Ravel, which, like the Beethoven, did not debut well. It debuted as a piano piece, and it was hissed and booed. Eventually orchestrated and turned into the orchestral piece that we are going to hear. So... would you have a clue, you not having been there, nor I, what it was about this particular piece of music that set that first audience's teeth on edge?
I'm not so sure, but I think, you know, they might have had a certain expectation going to it if they knew the Schubert on which it was based, because what Ravel's inspiration was a set of waltzes, two separate sets of waltzes that Schubert wrote much earlier, of course, with the same titles, Noble and Sentimental Waltzes, but there were two independent sets. And Ravel was really drawn to them. He thought they were beautifully constructed, very, you know, the clarity of the line and the form he was very attracted to. So he wanted to sort of do his own version of them and put his own voice into that idea. He doesn't quote from Schubert directly at all, so there's no, I mean, you don't really hear any Schubert except for the fact that they are waltzes. They are in, you know, triple meter, and the structure of them is somewhat similar. But beyond that, there's really no trace of Schubert in it, except for the, you know, the things that are more difficult to sort of put your hand on in terms of the air of it, the inspiration, the mood, the feeling, and I think it's brilliant what Ravel did, but you know, it's purely an artistic exercise on his part, I think, and he even put a quote in the orchestral score. I haven't seen the piano music myself, the sheet music, but, you know, something about art for art's sake, sort of thing.
The delicious and forever new pleasure of a useless occupation.
That is it. Thank you. Yes. And so when you read that, you think, okay. But you have to go at it from a standpoint of fantasy, because it's all about this other world that you're sort of going into. And, you know, Ravel loved the waltz. I mean, of course, La Valse was another piece that he famously wrote about sort of the death of the waltz. But this is not about the death of the waltz. This is more about the waltz as a vehicle for an exploration of the imagination. And I think it wasn't a complete failure, because it resonated with a famous dance company, ballet company, which approached Ravel and said, hey, would you be willing to maybe orchestrate this so we could dance it and make a choreography to it and have a production? And Ravel accepted. So that's how we got the orchestra version. Otherwise, it would probably still be a piano piece. And if you look at the dance version, it's fascinating, because the subject matter is again, very... it's very much about the imagination and very artistic, sort of esoteric ideas. There's a lot of symbolism. There are a few main characters, and it's about, you know, two rival suitors and a woman who's the object of their affections, who's sort of like almost like a Violetta and Traviata, you know, the courtesan type. And throughout the dance version, they use flowers, different flowers for symbols. So, you know, there's like the honeysuckle, and there's you know, the tuberose, or is that how you pronounce that? I'm not sure, which represents her voluptuousness, and there's a acacia branch, which represents platonic love, I think. And it's you go through all this, and so each character in the ballet presents that they exchange these different types of flowers, which I guess the public at the time was supposed to know what they represented. And it follows this sort of arc, and each movement has a very, very different mood about it. And, you know, once I found out all that about the ballet, it made the score a little bit more logical to me, because it's difficult to perform well, because on the surface it seems rather simple, but it's actually not. There's a lot of very subtle detail, subtle shading, subtle phrasing, nuance that has to be brought out in order to really make it shine.
So tell us about that nuance. And you're right. Once this was orchestrated, people loved it, loved it. So what is the nuance? What kind of undercurrent are we as the audience going to be listening for as the RPO plays the Noble and Sentimental Waltzes?
Well, the way that he treats the waltz itself, in terms of, you know, it's always in three, triple meter of some sort. So, you know, you get a couple, the first movement is just, it's the party scene. So it's a very traditional, well, it's not traditional in the sense that you hear it and you think, oh, wow, Vienna, of course, waltz, you know. But it's a French waltz, so you get the la-da-da-dun-da-da-da-da, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and it's very clear that you could dance the waltz to it. But even within that framework, it's pretty obvious. There's also a lot of beautiful shading and diminuendos, crescendos, little details that come out even in that first movement that have to be respected in order to really make the piece come alive. Because if you just played it 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, you know, with a little bit too heavily or without attention to the longer line, I think it really doesn't do it justice. Then when we get into the other movements, the waltz tempo, the pace of it, 1, 2, 3, slows down considerably, but it still has to dance. So you still have to maintain that emphasis on the 1, a little bit less on the 2, and maybe 3 with a little bit of lift. So we have that feeling of movement, even though it's much slower. And then over the top of that, the long lines, which are, you know, meant to represent, I guess, the emotions of the characters involved, the balance is very, very delicate. And there are a lot of places where, you know, one person, one instrument will have a piano dynamic and another will have a mezzo forte with a quick diminuendo, so that that one color has to emerge for just a split second and then come back into the texture. And it's a very active texture, even though it's very... very subdued music on the surface, but if you just, you know, listen a little bit harder, you'll hear a tremendous amount of detail.
Now compare and contrast the noble and sentimental waltzes with the second set of waltzes that we are going to be hearing, which comes from one of your favorite composers, Richard Strauss, and Der Rosenkavalier.
Oh, well, it's Rosenkavalier is one of my very, very favorite pieces. I thought of one other thing that I wanted to point out about the Ravel, though, before we move on, if you don't mind. The one of the movements, so we follow the three main characters. There's Adelaide, who's the woman of whom I spoke earlier, and then there's two suitors, and one is a rich duke, and one is just sort of an everyman, you know, typical guy who's very fond of her, and she's toying with both of them throughout. And there's one movement where Ravel takes the waltz, and it's still in there, but you have 3-2, which is three half notes in a bar, and 6-4. So it's still, you can break it down into three, but the accent pattern is very jarring because it's one of them, it's the, not the Duke, the other character, pursuing Adelaide and sort of heartbroken or very sad because he's getting rejected, but he's still pursuing her and he's trying to, you know, trying to win her back, but he's a little awkward about it. So you get... You still get 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, but it's ba-da-dee, ba-da-dee, da-da-dee, da-da-dee, da-da-ba. So the accent pattern is shifting constantly, and I think it makes it very interesting to follow. But if you listen for those groups of three, they're there throughout.
And Der Rosenkavalier, also a love triangle.
Yeah, groups of three, nice segue. It's a very, I mean, it's a long work in its entirety, the opera. But this suite is wonderful because it takes most of the best music. I mean, there's so much. The one scene that isn't quoted that is just stunning is the Marschallin's solo aria in the first act. But without a Marschallin, it's more difficult to pull that off in a purely orchestral setting. But you do get the great trio at the end of the opera, which is featured prominently in the suite as well. And It's a beautiful story. It's the result of, you know, one of the Hofmannsthal collaborations that Strauss had. And I love the story of Strauss said when he first got the libretto and he read it, he said it was such an ingenious libretto and such a beautiful story that the music practically wrote itself. So he was clearly very inspired. And it's interesting because the whole concept of the Rosenkavalier, you know, the title of it, and, you know, it's this... this man who is supposed to present a ceremonial silver rose to a woman who's set to be married in an arranged marriage situation. And that's all. When I first learned about Rosenkavalier, I thought, oh, I wasn't aware of that tradition. And then I, you know, read more and more about it. And then I found out that was entirely Hofmannsthal's invention. That never happened. But you believe it in the opera. It's, oh, okay, this, you know, because it's part of that sort of courtly world, you know, in years, bygone years. But it's also a very modern plot because, you know, it's about a young man and a much older woman who have a very real, a very true, I think, love for one another, but it's doomed to fail in the end. And I think they both know that, but the Marschallin knows it before the young man, Octavian, does. And then, you know, of course, when Octavian meets Sophie, Octavian is the Rosenkavalier, so he's supposed to go present this rose, and when he goes to present the rose to Sophie, they fall immediately in love, and Octavian knows he's in trouble, and Sophie, who's supposed to be marrying someone else, isn't sure what's going on either, but their attraction is like, you know, everyone in the room can feel it, you know, the two of them more than anyone, of course. So it's a difficult situation. But then at the very end, the Marshalin is, you know, very graceful and gracious in how she accepts it because she knows it's right. And so she lets him go. And he gets to be with Sophie, and she exits with all of her dignity, and I think they with love too. It's a peaceful, happy ending, even though your heart is breaking for the Marshalin, and a little bit, you know, for Octavian, but you know that he'll be better off with Sophie. So it's and the way Strauss does it musically is, I mean, it's really indescribable. It's just so. The build to the last climax is something that I look forward to every time I've played the opera, every time I've listened to it. And, you know, there's a lot of less lofty music in Der Rosenkavalier, I have to say. I mean, there's this other character, Baron Ox, who's a rather crude, coarse fellow, and he's not a very very good guy. I mean, he's always chasing everything with a skirt that moves. He's obnoxious. He's trying to arrange this marriage so he can get his hands on this new money of this guy's family, and you know he's got a title, so the nouveau rich guy wants the title, so it's sort of a marriage of convenience, and nothing about Ox is attractive at all. So you get this sort of comic relief in this buffoon, oafish character in Ox, and so there's a lot of that music in the opera too. And every time I would play it, because I performed it as an orchestra musician quite frequently, and every time I see the opera, there's a moment or two, usually, depending on the production, where I think, okay, enough of this, you know, let's move on. But once you get to that trio at the end, oh my God, it's worth every minute. But for the suite, it's interesting because Strauss himself didn't really write this suite. The publisher didn't give anyone else credit. It just says by Richard Strauss, but the suite was made in the mid-40s, right after World War II, and Strauss was sort of in financial ruin, as were many people in Europe and specifically in Germany. And so he liked the idea of a new piece being published that he could get a little bit of money in his pocket for. But the person who is most often credited with it is Artur Rozhinsky, who was the music director of the New York Philharmonic at the time, with the possible assistance of his young assistant at the time at the New York Philharmonic, a little-known man by the name of Leonard Bernstein. and it's interesting because a lot of people have asked me over the years, do you think Leonard Bernstein really wrote the Rosenkavalier Suite? And I said, I don't know. Maybe he helped. He never took credit for it, so I mean, and he conducted it a lot. In fact, if you go online, the New York Philharmonic has their archives, which are made public. It's great. It's such a fascinating resource. And you can see the original score where they cut and pasted. And you know, I'm a Bernstein fan, so I've looked at a lot of Bernstein's manuscripts, and it doesn't look like his handwriting, except in a couple cases. I think, maybe that's Lenny's handwriting. So I think Rozhinsky did it, and maybe Bernstein was involved, but he was very young. He was, you know, the assistant. This was before his career had exploded. But I think whoever did it, they did a wonderful job of including all the drama and all the passion and making it a successful concert piece. Because in the opera, you have the trio, and everyone is sort of floating in this ecstasy and this wonderful, beautiful ether at the end, and then it ends rather abruptly, but cutely, with, you know, little Muhammad running out and this sort of very, you know, very delightful kind of dainty music. But that's not what we have in the suite. After the trio, we get the return of sort of Ox's exit music, and that's interesting because the context. So Ox, I just, you know, told you what an awful guy he was, and they actually get back at him later in the opera, and the way that they free up Sophie so that she can be with Octavian is that they embarrass Ox by setting up this elaborate ruse where he gets a fake letter from a woman, a chambermaid that he had made inappropriate advances toward earlier in the opera. And so they trick him into thinking she's going to meet him. Meanwhile, people are hiding in the room he's in, waiting to see him, you know, act inappropriately. And then they come in one after the other and accuse him of all sorts of other things, illegitimate children. They're you know, debt collectors after him. And so when we get to the end, it's this very raucous waltz. But it starts rather, it sort of tripping along because Ox is drunk in the scene. So it's very uneven at the beginning, but it's very, again, very nuanced. When you get to that section in the orchestra, you'll hear a waltz that keeps, it wants to get started, but it never does get started because there's all this back and forth. And it's the letter being read to him first, to Ox, and his realization that, oh, maybe I'm going to have a chance with this girl I was hitting on earlier. And then he's very pleased with himself and thinking he's, you know, the bee's knees. And so he sort of waltzes out, and that's when the waltz first, you know, starts to get some sort of regular gait about it, because, as I said in the beginning, it's very broken up and very choppy, I guess. A lot of back and forth, a lot of pushing and pulling, stopping and starting. But then whoever did the arrangement makes a great transition to the trio music, so we get this moment of very sincere emotion and very weighty ideas and, you know, feelings. But then after it's all over, you get the return of Ox's music, and it's very extroverted, it's very joyous, it's fun, and it just ends with a real bang, and I think the audience is going to love it.
It's an interesting piece, too, because it's not a plot synopsis at all, but a series of moments.
Right, exactly, and they're woven together so beautifully it's a piece that I always love to conduct, because it's got so much great music, and, you know, I'm a great fan of Strauss, so it's always great to do any Strauss with the orchestra.
Is there a Strauss that might be a lesser-known Strauss that you really have your eye on at some point for the future with the RPO?
Well, I would love to do Alpine Symphony at some point. It's one of my favorite pieces, but it's a huge, big, epic piece. I like Capriccio, too, but, you know, that's an opera, so that would be if we ever had a situation where that would be appropriate, because we only do one opera a year, so, you know, it's really tough to decide. But Capriccio is a very beautiful beautiful work, and actually you can do either on its own or attached to the last aria. You can do the Moonlight music, you know, at the very end of the opera. So there's that. Intermezzo is interesting. I like Daphne too, Salome, but those are more well known, I suppose. Electra is really thrilling too. I mean, there's no bad Strauss. I love Strauss. I love it all.
How old were you when you realized Strauss was your guy?
Oh, I don't. You know, I came to Strauss much later than, say, Beethoven. I mean, I knew some of the works, but I didn't really know it in depth until I got my job in an opera orchestra. Because, you know, Strauss's operas are probably, well, it's tough to say, but maybe his greatest achievements. And because the tone poems are fantastic too. But it was definitely during my time at Lyric Opera Chicago that I really started to love and appreciate fully how much of a genius and great artist Strauss was.
Well, we'll be putting on our dancing shoes for this next concert. Because
yes, dancing our way into 2017.
Absolutely, with a little Beethoven, a little Strauss, a little Ravel. Ward, thank you for stopping by again and talking to us. Ward Steer is the music director of your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra. And if you would like some information about the RPO season, you can go to rpo.org. I'm Julia Figueres. This podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.